Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear a lot about rural areas that don't have access to high-speed internet. Our guest says it's a big problem in urban America for some surprising reasons. First, presidential candidates are spending a lot of time campaigning in Iowa ahead of the state's caucus in February. That kicks off a primary season where the rules can feel a little bit random. Some states have caucuses, others have primary elections, and those can be open to anyone, restricted to party members, or kind of somewhere in between. So how did we end up with this mix-and-match fractured primary system, and how does it impact who ultimately gets nominated? Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow in governance studies and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. She's the author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, primary season hasn't always been the way it is now. When did kind of our modern system, still a patchwork, come into being?
The modern nomination system came into being in 1972. It was the direct result of reforms that the Democratic Party started in 1968 after their very raucous convention and a lot of disruption within the party. And from 1972 on, the Democratic system changed pretty dramatically, and the Republican system changed as well. So it's really 1972 on that we consider the modern nominating system.
And that's an important point. I think a lot of us think elections, that's something run by the government. But in these primaries, in determining who's running on each ticket for president, the parties have a lot to say about it.
Well, yes. Basically, the nomination of somebody to be the standard bearer of a party is the business of the party. It's not a wide publicized business. In most of the democracies of the world, a very much smaller group of people who are party officials control the nomination process. They determine who gets to run as their standard bearer. What we did that, by the way, prior to 1972. What happened with the reforms that started to take place in 72 is that we moved as a nation from having party officials determine the nominee of their party to having voters in primaries determine the nominee of the party. And that was a pretty dramatic change, even in the American context, but definitely in the context of democracies around the world.
Did that change the role of the party then? Because once upon a time, I think it would have been unimaginable to have someone on the Republican ticket or Democratic ticket who wasn't a longtime party member. Now we have Donald Trump, who wasn't really a Republican, and then second place to Bernie Sanders, who wasn't really a Democrat. That's kind of a new innovation, right?
Right. That's very new. In the pre-1972 system, you would not have had Trump or Sanders winning or even coming close to winning the nomination of the party, because one of the things that was valued was service to and loyalty to the party. So the party – that didn't mean that the parties didn't have, by the way, their internal ideological fights. They certainly did. But they were fought out amongst people like in 1964, Barry Goldwater, who was a very, very conservative Republican, kind of a harbinger of the conservative Republican Party we see today, and more moderate Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller. But both of them were people with substantial public sector experience and a long history with the Republican Party.
Let's now look at the system we have in place. Here in Wisconsin, we have a primary. It's an open primary. You can go in and vote. You have to stick with just one party in that particular election, but you don't have to register as a member. Our neighbors, some of whom are listening in Iowa, they have caucuses. It seems like they're in caucuses all the time. What's the deal with caucuses for those of us not in a caucus state? How do they work?
Well, the big difference between a caucus and a primary is that in a caucus, the voter has to actually attend a meeting and participate in a meeting. So, you know, in a primary, you can go vote after you drop off the kids for school or before you go to work or after work or any time you want to during the day. In a caucus, it takes place at a certain time, usually from like 7 p.m. till 10 p.m., and you go and you vote as you go in, but then if your candidate doesn't reach the 15% threshold, you get to vote again for a candidate who is more popular. So, and there's usually other business conducted at that caucus as well, the platform resolutions, et cetera. So it's a more intensive form of participation, but it also involves less people because not everybody can take the kind of time you need to go to a caucus.
Do caucuses generally have a different kind of outcome? Do they favor one type of candidate over another?
Well, in both parties, caucuses have tended to favor candidates who have intense followings, sometimes ideological, sometimes not. So, for instance, in the 2008 race between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama did much better in caucuses than Hillary did. In fact, as my book shows, most of his delegate advantage versus Hillary in 2008 came from his big wins in caucus states. So Hillary had sort of widespread support, but not very deep. And Obama had also widespread support, but a lot of it was very intense. So it's a kind of measure. Sometimes it's an ideological intensity. Sometimes it's just simply a depth of feeling for your candidate because the caucus requires a lot more time than the primary does.
Talking to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution, author of the book Primary Politics. We're talking about how we nominate presidents for the major party tickets in this country. You can join in if you have thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Elaine, I've been reading we now have fewer caucus states this time around. It seems like the trend is away from caucusing. Is that right?
Yeah, we are down to about six caucus states, not counting the sort of territories and you know, places that aren't states. We're down to six. And this is a result of two things. First of all, there was a commission after the 2016 campaign that looked at these and recommended that states that had primaries on the law, on statute, should really start using their primaries because simply a lot more people can participate in primaries. Because of the nature of a caucus, if you're disabled, if you're elderly, if you've got a new baby at home, if you're deployed in the military, you really can't participate easily in a caucus. The second reason that the caucuses are kind of disappearing is that we are in a day and age of intense polarization, but that also means intense interest and turnout. And frankly, some of these big states, the number of people participating in caucuses is huge. And while on the one hand, that was very good because obviously, we want a lot of people to be interested in and participate in politics. On the other hand, it creates a burden for that system that states just had trouble managing. And a lot of us on the Rules Committee in the Democratic Party, and I think I can speak for my fellow rules junkies in the Republican Party, were afraid that these caucuses were simply too big to manage effectively anymore.
Then there's the question of the order in which we do these things. Iowa goes first. New Hampshire does it second. I think South Carolina is third. I assume somewhere there's a stone tablet where that order is carved and never shall it be violated, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, this has been the order, the sequence, who goes first, is something that emerged after the Democratic reforms and in the new primary system. New Hampshire was always first. New Hampshire has been first since the turn of the century, since about 1921 or something. Okay, it's always been the first primary. What made it more important is that when we went to a system of all primaries, something called momentum developed. And what momentum really means is that the decision of voters in one contest has an impact on the decision of voters in the next contest and on and on throughout the 4 or 5 months of the nomination season. So New Hampshire got to be very important. And before it, Iowa got to be very important. Iowa becomes important in 1976 when Jimmy Carter, a total unknown, emerges really out of nowhere and wins the Iowa caucus and then goes on to win the nomination and the presidency. So these two states particularly have held on to their first place for quite some time. We went through a couple years where everybody was complaining about this, and one of the sources of complaints was that those are both states that are majority white with very few minorities. So the Democrats in the 2000s added South Carolina, which has a very large African-American population, and Nevada, which has a very large Latino population. And then in a surprising bit of bipartisan cooperation, the two political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, agreed to hold the same sequence of primaries. So for the last few races, last few times nomination contests have been held, both the Republican parties and the Democratic parties begin their nomination system in those four states. And that has lessened the confusion and also stopped, at least temporarily, other states from trying to jump the queue and causing chaos in the system.
We're talking to Elaine K. Marx, senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She's the author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. We are talking about the patchwork system we have for presidential primaries, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that baffles you about our nomination system? I promise you're not alone. Do you think it should be more uniform? What type of election would you like to see be the standard? Is there something in either party system or both party system that you think needs to change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Elaine K. Marx from the Brookings Institution, author of the book Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. And you can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how the nomination system works, the primaries, the caucuses, and so forth? Would you like to see one model for how we do it that works in every state? Should the order change? What do you want to see change, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elaine, I've seen an argument that kind of decreasing the power of the party to control who gets nominated might be a mixed blessing. I mean, some people didn't like the smoke-filled rooms necessarily where the party faithful decided who it was going to be. But some people have also said, hey, wait a minute, you're basically just saying that it's so important who the president is, the personality, it makes this one power block for the personality of the president. Where do you fall on that back and forth?
Well, I do think it's a mixed bag. I mean, there were lots of problems with the smoke-filled rooms. On the other hand, they did nominate Dwight D. Eisenhower, Franklin Roosevelt, and a bunch of other presidents that we think are pretty good. In the old-fashioned system, it was a system where basically elected officials of that party and party leaders of that party had the final say over who became their nominee. The advantage of the old system was that they actually, unlike the voters today, these people actually knew the potential presidents, and they could make judgments about that person's temperament, about their ability to work across the aisle, ability to work with the legislature, ability to understand complex public policy issues, and whether or not the person could get elected. There was something in that we call peer review. Now, think about this. If you are going to have brain surgery, you want somebody who has been peer reviewed as a doctor who is competent at cutting open your brain. And ditto for many other things, even manicurists, right? We have our manicurists get licensed because we want to make sure that they know what their job is. The Office of President of the United States is one of the few important jobs in the country where we have no peer review anymore. And that means that celebrity makes a big difference. And so celebrity can get you onto a debate stage. Celebrity can get you people calling you a potential president of the United States. So in the last couple of years, we've had spiritual gurus, we've had pizza entrepreneurs, we've had all sorts of people running for president who, frankly, in the old system, and not to mention reality television stars, running for president who in the old system would have never been considered seriously for president. My sense here is that we need to have elements of both in a nomination system and that we've gone too far in the other direction, and it's potentially very dangerous.
Let's bring on our callers now. Joe is with us in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Joe?
I was wondering if there has been any push towards a national primary wherein all states would primary on the same day to possibly remove some of that momentum that was spoken about before. Seems to me that momentum is a sort of a way of kind of negating the whole idea of like a secret ballot. If you see that 49 states have already voted towards a particular candidate, you'd be less likely to vote against that.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Elaine, this would be a big change. Have people made the case for that in the past?
Yeah, Joe brings up a really good point. There have been lots of calls for a national primary. It would have to be done through Congress, right? And Congress has been very loath to get involved in the business of nomination because, as I said at the outset, this is basically a party decision, not a public decision. And the two political parties have never been very interested in a national primary. So you would need an act of Congress. There have been over 100 bills introduced over the years to establish a national primary. None of them have gotten out of committee. None of them have even gone to a vote. And even if one did to a vote and pass, there is a constitutional question about whether or not Congress has the right to do that. So it's one of those ideas that makes total common sense to everybody, but it really has a lot more aspects to it than you initially think. Second is that there has been this feeling, and this may be changing, that we kind of like a system that lets some unknown person emerge out of nowhere and catch the imagination and go on to win the nomination and potentially the presidency. That too may be changing as we consider the impact of a president that we currently have who doesn't have much experience, and it kind of shows in the chaotic way that his presidency has unfolded.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about America's presidential nomination system with Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution. Back to your calls. Dennis is with us in Milwaukee. Dennis, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dennis?
Well, my question on all the nomination business and voting and all of that, et cetera, I just keep wondering why we still have the Electoral College.
Oh, very good question, Dennis.
A later stage in the process, but sure.
We still have the Electoral College because it is in the Constitution of the United States, and you would have to have a constitutional amendment and a constitutional convention in order to get rid of it. So, and that's a very, very big deal, and nobody's been interested in going there for quite some time. Now, there are some options out there which are kind of interesting. Even though the Electoral College is the way we eventually pick a president, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that the Electoral College has to be winner-take-all by state, which is what it is in all but two states, Maine and Nebraska. So there's an idea going around called the Electoral Compact, where states would sign up, and if they got to 270, which is the number of electoral votes needed to win, they they would cast their electors or cast their electoral votes according to the nationwide winner, not the statewide winner. And that idea has gotten some traction, and it has some appeal because it doesn't involve opening up the Constitution and amending the Constitution. But basically, it's the Constitution, the explicitness of the Electoral College in the Constitution, which makes it so hard to change.
Time. Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Kurt is with us in Elkhorn. Kurt, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having the show. Yeah. You know, I've got something that is so less complicated than everything that's been suggested. I mean, if we want to get primaries up and voting up, let's just do like they do across the pond. Either make the voting day a national holiday, or hey, let's put it on a Saturday. You know, sometime when, you know, all the people out there that really want to vote would have the time to get transportation and there would be a lot more things available. I mean, this is just too simple, and I understand why they don't want to do it. But
thanks a lot for the call. Just a couple minutes left. Elaine, here in Wisconsin, and I think in most states, it's a Tuesday primary, just like it's Tuesday elections.
Yeah. Kurt's absolutely right. The main reason why in other countries they vote more than we do is that they either have it on a weekend or they have it on a holiday. I totally agree with him. It's something that we should do, and nobody has done it yet, but we can still hope.
Thanks a lot for that. You know, what would be interesting, Elaine, you mentioned that people like to see that Cinderella story. Somebody comes out of nowhere and makes a name in the primary process. Something that used to happen that was more dramatic was the contested primary, where the party would have to vote 83 times to get James Garfield on the ballot or whatever the case. I made up that number,
right.
Something like that. Are we ever going to go back to the days of the contested convention?
Oh, we very well could. I mean, we haven't had it because momentum seems to carry somebody to an eventual win by the time the primaries are over. But any time that the primaries are inconclusive, in other words, if you have, let's say you have three candidates and they're all going into a convention with hundreds of delegates to their names, you're going to have a contested convention. Just because it tends not to happen lately doesn't mean that it's impossible. And it certainly could happen. And at that point, we would see something that we really haven't seen since the 1950s. We would see an old-fashioned convention where the delegates themselves would be bargaining with each other and talking with each other and trying to come to a conclusion. And that would be pretty interesting.
Elaine, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, author of the book Primary Politics. She joined us to talk about why presidential nominations are so different from state to state and how it impacts who gets nominated.